People drifted onto the beach. Bodies that had remained on the beach all night moved. Some wandered down to the dunes to relieve themselves. Some did not bother to go to the dunes. No one spoke. They looked into each other's eyes and got the message that Fat Sam had not yet received delivery. For a while, Fat Sam sat cross-legged in the opening of his lean-to, taking the morning sun. No one approached him. To a stranger, it would all look like young people sitting silently, half asleep, on the beach on a Sunday morning. Fletch saw the fear, the anxiety, the desperation in the darting eyes, the extraordinary number of cigarettes being smoked, the suppressed shaking of the hands. He heard the shattering silence. Some of these people had been hanging fire 2 or 3 days. At 10:30, Gummy returned to the beach. He sat alone. Over his long jeans, he was wearing a Hawaiian shirt like a tent. His shoulders seemed no wider than the back of his neck. His face in profile was hawkish. He sat absolutely still, staring straight in front of him. Bobby came to the beach, and Creasy, and Sando, and July. They sat close to Fletch. No one said a word. Fat Sam had moved back into the shadows of his lean-to. He had withdrawn. "Jesus," Sando said. People began to move toward the lean-to. People in shorts, jeans, shirtless, bikinis. People carrying nothing but money. The store was open. Fletch had not perceived a signal of any sort. First Creasy, then Bobby. They stood around outside the lean-to, not speaking, looking at their feet, their hands, not at each other, ashamed of their desperation. July, Bing Crosby, Gummy, Florida, Filter Tip, Jagger. Fletch stood with them, milling, in and out of the lean-to. Somebody must have dropped something. There was a supply. Everything. Fat Sam was dealing. People who had been served began to hustle off the beach. Squirrels with nuts to store. They were going to stash. They were going to relieve their tensions. They were going to shoot up. Fletch backed away, imitating the face of someone who had bought, who was all right. Bobby had scurried. Down the beach, Fletch jumped into the ocean. The morning cold salt water helped glue the separate parts of his head together. The blood was too congealed to wash out of his hair. Walking back to his pad, past the Sunday morning closed stores of ordinary commerce, he heard the church bells ring. It was Sunday noon, and everyone was shooting up. Fletch slept past midnight. Chapter 17. When Fletch woke at 2:45 Monday morning, he found Bobby lying in the sleeping bag beside him. He had not heard or felt her come in. It took him a moment to realize she was dead. The back of his scalp tingling, he scrambled out of the sleeping bag. As he knelt in the moonlight beside her, his scream choked with horror. Her eyes appeared to have receded entirely into her head. Her left arm was puffy at the elbow and shoulder. She showed no vital signs. He guessed she had overdosed. He spent until dawn ridding the room of every sign of her. Until 11 o'clock, then, he sat cross-legged on the floor in the center of the room, rock still, thinking. Chapter 18. Early Monday afternoon, Fletch spent 40 minutes under a warm shower in his own apartment. He had driven up from the beach at about the pace of a hearse. Bobby was dead and sort of buried. He washed his hair 5 times. Finally, the blood, the sand, the congealed mess was gone. A crooked, narrow abrasion under his hair was sore to the touch of his fingertips. Sitting on the divan under the distillerie, he ate 2 delicatessen sandwiches and drank a bottle of milk. On the coffee table in front of him was the big tape recorder. On the wall across from him was a copy of William James's Cherry Beach. After he had finished the sandwiches and milk, he went into the bedroom and lay on the bed. Facing him was a copy of Frederick Weiss's 1968 photograph of a boy apparently walking in midair beneath 2 roofs, boy jumping. Fletch said, "Bobby," and picked up the phone and dialed the Nevada number. "Swartout, Nevada Realty Company." It was the same voice that had answered Saturday. "Jim Swartout, please." I'm not sure Mr. Swartout... Oh, here he is, sir. One moment, please. Fletch sat up on the bed. He had to put Bobby out of his mind now. Lighten his voice. Be convincing. Jim Swartout speaking. Hi, Jim. This is Bill Carmichael. Bill Carmichael? I'm a stockbroker for a bunch of thieves out here on the coast known as John Collins and all. The John Collins family. Oh, yeah. How are you, Bill? I think we've met, Fletch said. Well, if you've ever in your life seen an overweight, bald-headed man who was probably drunk at the time, we've met. Alan tells me you're doing a deal with him. Alan who? Alan Stanwyck. Who's Alan Stanwyck? The guy who married Joan Collins. Oh, John's son-in-law. Yeah. Anyway, Alan told me about his buying the ranch, and as I might be interested in buying a little piece of real estate out your way myself, I thought I'd give you a ring. The stock market, you know, Jim, isn't all it might be. I've never heard from him. From whom? Alan, what's his name? John Collins' son-in-law. You've never heard from him? Never. You said he's buying a ranch through me? A big spread, $15 million worth. Nope, it's not happening. Golly, I thought he said it was quite definite. Maybe he's just thinking about it. What's his phone number? Could he be dealing with someone else? No, if there's a $15 million ranch for sale anywhere in Nevada, I'd know about it. There isn't one. Amazing. I'd know if such a property were available anywhere in the state. And right now, there just isn't one. Let me say that over. I can almost perfectly guarantee you that nowhere in the state of Nevada at the present time is there a piece of real estate of such value being sold or bought. Of course, there's always a chance of a private deal between friends or family, where a broker isn't being used or consulted. But even then, I would be very much surprised if I hadn't heard about it. In any case, Alan Stanwyck is definitely not using you or your office to buy any real estate in Nevada? Definitely not. As I say, we've never heard from him. I'm sure we could find something for him, though.
Do me a favor, Jim.
Sure.
Don't call him. You'd just be embarrassing me and him, too. He mentioned it by the pool last night. He'd had a drink.
Talking big, huh?
I suspect so.
That's the way it is with these professional in-laws, always talking about what they're going to do with somebody else's money.
I guess so. He'd had a drink.
Well, if he ever gets serious, and if he ever gets his hands on any of his father-in-law's money, send him out to me.
I will, Jim.
Now, Bill, you said you were interested in a piece of property yourself.
I don't know what to say, Jim.
You were just checking on the old boy.
Something like that, Jim.
What are you, the family financial nursemaid?
Let's just say I asked a question.
And you got an answer. I understand. My own daughter's taking art lessons in Dallas, Texas, for Christ's sake.
Families, Jim, families.
I wouldn't trade jobs with you, Bill, but call any time you want. If old John's hired you to nursemaid Alan, what's his name, it's all right with me. Just wish I could hire you myself.
You're a sharp man, Jim. I owe you a drink.
John Collins does, and from him I'll accept.
Fletch returned to the living room and sat heavily on the divan. He continued to have a mild headache. Snapping on the microphone in his hand, he leaned back and closed his eyes. He spoke slowly.
Although it is my instinct at this point to ramble on regarding the nature of truth, particularly the illusory nature of truth, I shall do my best to confine the following remarks concerning the Alan Stanwyck murder mystery to facts as I now know them. One comment only for file, which may concern the nature of truth in general, or may more significantly concern the nature of facts specifically concerning Alan Stanwyck. To wit, almost every fact adequately confirmed about Alan Stanwyck has also been adequately denied. In the case of almost each fact, it would have been easy to accept simple confirmation from an authoritative source. Further checking, however, frequently has resulted in an equally authoritative denial of that fact. By now, in my investigation of Alan Stanwyck, I have talked, either in person or by telephone, with his secretary, his personal physician, his father, his wife, his father-in-law, his insurance man, who is also his old college roommate. Indirectly, through a third party, I have had testimony from the man's stockbroker.
I've had corporate and personal financial views of Stanwyck, and a social view of himself and his wife. I have had a police report on him. To the best of my ability, I have run this investigation in depth on him without there being any way of his knowing he's being investigated. I've used different names, different identities, and never have I pressed the questioning far enough for the person being questioned to be suspicious, with the exception of Jim Swartout in Nevada, and I believe I completely cooled his suspicions. He will not report the inquiry to either Stanwyck or his family. The portrait of Alan Stanwyck that has emerged so far is that of a bright, healthy, energetic, ambitious man, a man solid in his community, family, and business. I would even say a decent man. In fact, perhaps going a bit further than I should, a man of deep loyalties and principles. First, he has a clean police record, with the exceptions of a 6-month-old unpaid parking ticket from the city of Los Angeles, and the complaint that as a lieutenant in the Air Force, he buzzed a house with a training jet in San Antonio, Texas. From his stockbroker, William Carmichael, we know that Alan Stanwyck is in pretty good financial condition. On paper, he may presently be worth as much as $1 million. Eventually, because of both the nature of his employment and the nature of his marriage, he will both achieve personal wealth and share in, probably control, one of the world's great fortunes. Even with this ultimate circumstance inevitable, and despite maintaining the highest standard of living available for his immediate family, Stanwyck has salted away over $100,000 from salary over a very few years. The last few years, he must have been putting away $20,000 or $25,000 a year, simply because he hasn't needed it. This indicates, at least to me, that such a vice as compulsive gambling can be ruled out. The crime of embezzlement does not seem necessary. Apparently, Stanwyck is not being blackmailed. We have from his family physician and others good evidence that Stanwyck does not have a drinking problem or a drug problem. Not only is he under consistent, close scrutiny by professionals and others who depend upon Stanwyck's physical and mental performance, his way of life, his known witnessed habits, preclude his harboring such addictions. No one can play squash and tennis, sail, and especially fly experimental aircraft with reflexes and nerves shot by depressants. I think I can state as a fact that Alan Stanwyck drinks and smokes moderately, period. For what it is worth, from what must be called a streetwalker in the town in which he is currently living, the Hills, a young girl named Roberta Bobby Sanders had never seen Alan Stanwyck. It might therefore be said that he is not known to have frequented or cruised the sexual meat market most convenient to his residence. This does not mean that Alan Stanwyck's sexual activity is confined to the marital bed. There is good reason to suspect otherwise. However, it does indicate that Alan Stanwyck's sexual activities are controlled in acceptable social patterns. His stockbroker and presumed confidant, William Carmichael, doubts strongly that Alan Stanwyck maintains an extramarital sex life. Carmichael believes such an extramarital sex life would place in jeopardy Stanwyck's relations with his wife and thus with his father-in-law employer. However, without meaning to visit the sins of the wife upon the husband, I had the distinct impression that his wife, Joan Stanwyck, was perfectly willing to enjoy a sexual dalliance with this investigator. Her ardor may have been the result of tennis followed by martinis. This should be more thoroughly checked later. One suspects that if a wife is playing around, a husband is, although the reverse is not always true. If the wife is playing around as openly as it seems, at least she would have little to complain about the husband's extramarital affairs. We also have testimony from a contemporary of Stanwyck's father-in-law, News Tribune Society writer Amelia Shurcliffe, that extramarital affairs on the part of either Alan or Joan Stanwyck would not greatly disturb John Collins. Apparently, the old boy has every reason of his own to be most understanding regarding such matters. According to Mrs. Shurcliffe, his own sexual activities have not been entirely confined to the marital bed. Other matters concerning Alan Stanwyck's health are more confusing. So far, the only evidence that Alan Stanwyck has terminal cancer is from Alan Stanwyck's own mouth. His personal physician denies it. I take that back. His personal physician, Dr. Joseph Devlin of the Medical Center, states that as far as he knows, Alan Stanwyck is in perfect health. He states he has not referred him to any specialist, ever. He also states he has not given him a complete physical examination recently enough to be viable. His insurance company examines him every 6 months. Stanwyck's insurance agent, an old college chum, Bert Eberhardt, also states that Alan Stanwyck is in perfect physical condition. Although he did make an interesting slip, Freudian or otherwise, he said, "I'll play so close to the chest he wouldn't tell you if he were dying of cancer." I have since confirmed that Dr. Joseph Devlin is heavily invested in Collins Aviation. My source is Joan Collins Stanwyck. I've confirmed from several sources that if it were known that Stanwyck is terminally ill, at least until Stanwyck has a chance to prepare the company for his absence, Collins Aviation would be in financial trouble. Bert Eberhardt, besides being Stanwyck's personal insurance man, is the broker for all Collins Aviation insurance. One can presume Eberhardt is also heavily invested in Collins Aviation. Mentioning cancer casually to Stanwyck's wife, father, and father-in-law caused no discernible reaction, unless everyone is a very good actor and superbly in control of his emotions, or in complete ignorance. The people closest to Alan Stanwyck are not thinking of cancer in relation to him. Therefore, this investigation is drawing a complete blank. No aberrations or abnormalities are apparent thus far in Alan Stanwyck's financial, sexual, or health areas. Alan Stanwyck's social relations seem splendid. According to society writer Amelia Shercliffe, the Stanwycks present a rather nice, solid, possibly dull image. She even believes they may be in love with each other. Alan Stanwyck could not have fitted into this society of extreme wealth and responsibility without undergoing intensive, envious scrutiny. He must have a good glove maker. Clearly, he has not committed the faux pas of ostentation, silliness, aloofness, what have you. He is generally admired and respected. The same is true among his intimates. I would say he is intensely admired among family and close friends. Not that he is without criticism. His wife wishes he had more time for her. His father-in-law wishes he had a better sense of humor. His father wishes he wouldn't spend so much time on the telephone. His old friend Bert Eberhardt wishes Alan weren't always so serious. Everyone wishes he would stop flying experimental aircraft. More publicly, the fact that he married the boss's daughter does not go unnoticed. But, as someone pointed out, someone had to. And after listening to Bert Eberhardt, Cara Dean, Carmichael, and John Collins himself, I would guess Alan Stanwyck is the best thing that has ever happened to Collins Aviation. The score seems balanced. Alan Stanwyck is not taking a free ride, as one such as Jim Swartout of Swartout Nevada Realty is quick to assume. Now for a few of the contradictions in facts this investigation thus far has revealed. Alan Stanwyck says he is dying of terminal cancer. No one else says so. If he is, no one else knows it. Stanwyck's wife and father-in-law say that Stanwyck is estranged from his parents, yet he visits them all the way across the country every 6 weeks. The reason given for the estrangement is that his father forced him to box, yet his father insists he urged Alan not to box. Despite the fact that, confirmed by a call to the Nonhegan Inn, that Alan visits his parents every 6 weeks, he has never told them that he has a child and that they have a grandchild. Everyone says that Alan Stanwyck is buying a ranch in Nevada. His wife, his father-in-law, his stockbroker, his insurance man. Everyone, that is, except the person whom both Stanwyck's wife and insurance man identify as the real estate broker, Jim Swartout. It was quite clear from his attitude, as well as from his explicit statements, that Swartout has never done business with or even met Alan Stanwyck. To some extent, these contradictions can't be explained, now that we have some knowledge of the man. I take the clue from Bert Eberhardt's statement. "Al plays so close to his chest he wouldn't tell you he was dying of cancer." Although no one knows it, Alan Stanwyck could have terminal cancer. There can be an answer to his strange relations with his parents. He could love them very much. Being an only son, he could have a profound sense of loyalty and duty toward them. Apparently, he has for his old college roommate, Bert Eberhardt. As Marvin Stanwyck says, he could find stopping off in his old hometown frequently a restful experience. At the same time, he could realize that the world of John and Joan Collins is no place for Marvin and what's-her-name mother Stanwyck. He might feel they would be very out of place and very embarrassed. Therefore, he might have fudged the date of his wedding, not told them they were grandparents, and told everyone else he was estranged from his parents, solely to save their feelings. There is even an answer to the mysterious ranch in Nevada. He could have started to buy the ranch in Nevada for the best reason in the world, a good real estate investment. Neither he nor Joan needed to like the idea of living on a ranch. Thus the confusion in everybody's mind about whose idea the ranch is, Allen's or Joan's. Neither of them really wants to do it. Buying the ranch is simply a good business idea. It is possible he took the first steps toward buying the ranch, which first steps for him would have been seeking the advice of his stockbroker, insurance man, wife, and father-in-law. After he did this, he discovered he was dying of cancer. He had to devote his time and energies to cleaning shop at Collins Aviation, subtly, so that no one knew what he was doing. That would take some effort. He knew he would not be able to see the land purchase through, but he could not tell people so without also telling them why, that he has terminal cancer. Therefore, he kept talking about it as if it were a real developing thing. John Collins referred him to Jim Swartout. It is very likely that subsequently, when John Collins or whoever asked about Swartout and the ranch, Stanwyck answered, "Yes, yes, everything's fine." Doubtless, he even found himself agreeing to take his wife to the ranch next weekend when there isn't any ranch, because Stanwyck knows that for him, there isn't any next weekend. Even the contradictions could be made to go together. Yet there remains one overwhelming question in my mind. If Alan Stanwyck wishes to commit suicide, why doesn't he die the way everybody half expects him to die? Why doesn't he crash an airplane? Still moving slowly, Fletch disposed of his sandwich wrappings and carton of milk. In the bedroom, he carefully packed a large suitcase. Into it went tennis whites, 3 pairs of blue jean shorts, T-shirts, several dress shirts, neckties, underwear, his shaving kit, 2 suits, 2 sports jackets, 2 pairs of slacks, his address book, black shoes, 3 pairs of black socks, 3 pairs of brown socks, his passport. He put typing paper and carbon paper into his typewriter case and closed it. Then he dressed in brown loafers, brown socks, a dress shirt, necktie, trousers, and a sports jacket, and sunglasses. Taking his big tape recorder, typewriter case, and suitcase, he went to the apartment garage. He lashed the tape recorder to the passenger seat of the MG. He put the typewriter case behind the front seats and the suitcase in the trunk. Then he drove to the main gate of Collins Aviation and waited. Chapter 19. It was 4 o'clock when Fletch pulled up and parked across from the main gate of Collins Aviation. At 4:45, through sunglasses, he saw the gray uniformed guard at the gate step briskly out of his guardhouse, whistle and wave people aside, clear the road and the sidewalk, and casually salute a car coming through. It was the gray Jaguar XKE, license number 440001. It turned left into traffic. Alan Stanwyck was driving. Fletch followed him. Joan Stanwyck had said Alan worked late Mondays and Wednesdays. On those 2 days of the week, he seldom arrived home before midnight. He remained at the office. It was Monday. Stanwyck had left the office before 5. He continued down Stevenson to Main and turned right on Main. Following him, Fletch thought Stanwyck might be heading for the expressway toward the city. But after 12 blocks, Stanwyck turned left on Seabury. At the corner of Seabury and Bouvard, he pulled into the parking lot of a liquor store. Fletch waited across the street. Watching Stanwyck amble into the liquor store and out again, Fletch could only think him a well man, an unconcerned man, a relaxed man. As he went in, Stanwyck's hands were in the pockets of his slacks, his gait was slow and even, his face expressionless. When he came out, his face had the half-smile of someone who had just passed pleasantries. In the bag he was carrying were at least 3 bottles of liquor. It took him a moment to find the right key on his keychain for the ignition. Continuing the way he had been going, Stanwyck went another 3 blocks on Seabury and then turned left on Putnam. A half-mile along Putnam, he turned into the tree-shaded parking lot of a garden apartment development. He parked the Jaguar in the shade of the trees at the far side of the parking lot. Fletch parked in the middle row of the parking lot in the sunlight. Stanwyck locked his car. Carrying the bag of liquor, he strolled across the parking lot, cutting through the middle row of cars within 3 cars of Fletch, walked 15 yards down the sidewalk, turned left on a walk and into a doorway. Fletch waited 10 minutes by his dashboard clock. Then he went into the doorway himself. The doorway served two apartments. On the left, the name on the letterbox was Charles Rice. The box was full of mail. The mailbox on the right was empty. The name on that box was Sandra Faulkner. A sign in the recessed doorway warned trespassers and solicitors as well as loiterers and burglars. It was signed Green Brothers Management. Where's Gummy? Someone had gotten up enough energy to make a campfire on the beach. It was a reasonably cool night. Farther up the beach, there were other campfires. Vatsyayana said, Fletch. In a corner of the parking garage, Fletch had changed into jeans. Having had a sport coat on, he had not realized it had gotten cooler. He wished he had at least put on a t-shirt. Where's Gummy? He asked again. July said, I saw him earlier. Where did he go, did he say? July said, No. Anyone else seen Gummy? No one answered. Vatsyayana asked, Where's Bobby? Fletch said, She's split. For where? Vatsyayana's look was one of kindly concern. That great candy store in the sky. Vatsyayana said nothing. Rolled against the base of the seawall in a blanket, not far from where Fletch had placed the rock the night before, was Creasy. Fletch stood over him a moment in the dark, not sure whether Creasy was traveling or asleep. Creasy said, What's happening, man? I'm looking for Gummy, Fletch said. Oh, man, he's gone. What do you mean, gone? That kid's had it. I mean, how often can you be a beating bag for the fuzz? You don't know he's gone, Creasy said. He should have gone. Man, there has to be enough of everything. I mean, the kid's been beaten and been beaten. Then he gets home and his daddy whumps him. Everybody's beating up on that kid all the time. Fletch said, I'm looking for Gummy. Like my old skins. Man, I feel guilty for beating on them. Every night with sticks, drumsticks. I beat on those skins. Man, how do we know those skins don't have feeling? Suppose when I hit them, they hurt, really hurt. I don't know about that, Creasy. I've got a lot of painin' to do to make up for what I did. Don't you think the drums will forgive you? The Christly drums, that's the idea. Beat up on anybody, anything, as much as you want, even drums, and they must forgive you because that's what the man said, Christ. I'm looking for Gummy. Have you seen him? No, where's Bobby? Fletch said. She's all right. She's split. I haven't seen her in weeks. You saw her yesterday morning. Yeah, she was all strung out. She'd had it. Fletch, you know she'd had it. Last time I saw her. I didn't realize it. She'd had it. Is she gone? Yeah, she's gone. Jesus. Fletch stood a moment in the dark near Creasy, not looking at the rock, and then moved on. At another campfire, he sat down and waited a moment before speaking. No one was speaking. Anyone seen Gummy? No one answered. The kid with the jug ears they called Bing Crosby was looking expectantly at Fletch, as if waiting to hear what Fletch had just said. I'm looking for Gummy,